Live from the Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, Governor Kathy Hochul is raising millions of dollars for re-election, but the public hasn't seen her full schedule in more than a year. New reporting raises questions about who she's meeting with and why it matters. That story coming up. New York is facing a critical blood shortage, with donations falling far below hospital demand. We'll hear what's behind the decline and how local donors can help right now. Plus, how working with horses can help people build confidence, communication, and emotional connection. And culture reporter Valerie Manzi previews the Wintertide film series at Headwaters Arts Center in Roxbury. That's all coming up after this hour's news from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. President Trump is rolling out the inaugural members of his Board of Peace. He's at the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland. He initially presented this board as a group that would oversee Gaza after the ceasefire took hold. He's expanded that vision to include permanent member countries of a board that he controls indefinitely. Trump insists he'll work with the United Nations to settle world conflicts.
As everyone can see today, the first steps toward a brighter day for the Middle East and a much safer future for the world are unfolding right before your very eyes. Together, we are in a position to have an incredible chance. I don't even call it a chance. I think it's going to happen. To end decades of suffering, stop generations of hatred and bloodshed, and forge a beautiful, everlasting, and glorious peace.
More than a dozen countries have signed up to join. European leaders are meeting today to talk about President Trump's demand to take over Greenland. Trump says he will not use military force. Trump met Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky on the sidelines of the forum in Switzerland today. Zelensky says Europe needs to think hard about what it's going to do about Greenland.
Everyone turned attention to Greenland, and it's clear most leaders simply are not sure what to do about it. And it seems like everyone is just waiting for America to cool down on this topic, hoping it will pass away. But what if will not? What then?
Meanwhile, Zelensky says there will be meetings tomorrow and Saturday in the United Arab Emirates among officials from Ukraine, Russia, and the United States. These meetings are over Russia's war in Ukraine. President Trump's envoys are going to Moscow today to meet with Russian President Vladimir Putin. Stocks opened higher this morning as revised figures from the Commerce Department show the fastest economic growth in 2 years. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average jumped about 220 points in early trading.
The U.S. economy grew at an annual rate of 4.4% last July, August, and September, up from an initial tally of 4.3%. The upward revision reflects somewhat stronger exports and investments during the quarter that was partially offset by a downward revision to consumer spending. Procter & Gamble narrowly missed sales targets for its most recent quarter. The company says uncertain shoppers are skimping a bit on things like Tide laundry detergent and Charmin toilet paper. New applications for unemployment benefits showed little change last week, suggesting layoffs are still uncommon. As of early January, some 2.3 million people were receiving some form of jobless assistance. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow is now up about 200 points. You're listening to NPR. Vice President Vance is expected in Minnesota today. He'll join a roundtable with local residents about law and order in the state. Thousands of federal agents are in Minnesota for immigration operations. Vance's visit comes as a memo has surfaced from the acting director of ICE. The memo says federal immigration agents can barge into any home without first getting a warrant from a federal judge. Activists say that is a direct violation of the U.S. Constitution. Nominations for the 98th Academy Awards have been announced this morning in Los Angeles. As NPR's Netta Ulaby reports, the movie Sinners shattered records with the most nominations in history.
With 16 nominations, Sinners broke records set previously by movies such as Titanic, All About Eve, and La La Land. Each got 14 nominations. This year's second most nominated film, One Battle After Another, got 13. Other top Oscar contenders this year include Frankenstein, which got 9 nominations, as did the Norwegian drama Sentimental Value, a surprise favorite. Both were nominated for Best Picture, along with movies such as Begonia, F1, Marty Supreme, The Secret Agent, Train Dreams, and Hamnet. That film received 8 nominations, including Best Actress, and one for director Chloe Zhao, making her only the second woman to earn multiple Best Director nominations in Oscar history. The ceremony will be broadcast on March 15th. Netta Ulibi, NPR News.
The National Weather Service says a major winter storm will bring heavy snow and ice from the southern Rockies into the southeastern U.S. The weather starts tomorrow. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Lemelson Foundation, working to harness the power of invention and innovation to accelerate climate action and improve lives around the world. Learn more at lemelson.org. This is NPR.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for joining us. Governor Kathy Hochul promised a new era of transparency, and she's raising millions of dollars for re-election, but the public can't see who she's meeting with. Her schedule is more than a year out of date. We'll break that down with New York Focus reporter Chris Bragg in a few minutes. But first, Governor Hochul unveiled her budget proposal for the state for the next fiscal year on Tuesday. The $260 billion plan includes more investments in child care and education, as well as funding to ease the impact of federal budget cuts and tariffs. And as Samuel King with the New York Public News Network reports, the plan is boosted by more than $10 billion in unexpected revenue.
Governor Kathy Hochul says the state's strong revenues mean her budget can invest in new programs without raising taxes. Those revenues are coming from continued consumer spending and strong returns on Wall Street.
And that's why we're able to invest more without asking New Yorkers to pay more. So let me be clear about something else. This is not an austerity budget, but it is a disciplined one. And we're continuing to invest in core services that New Yorkers rely on while keeping the growth of state operating funds at a responsible level.
The budget includes her child care proposals and boosts in school aid, as well as major investments like $300 million for economic development and revitalization in Rochester. But that good news was counteracted by cuts in federal spending. Hochul is proposing the state spend about 11% more on Medicaid to make up the difference.
The federal government was a reliable partner, making sure the funds were there. In just 1 year, the Trump administration has shattered that trust, and we're bearing the brunt of it.
Fiscal watchdogs like Andrew Ryan with the Citizens Budget Commission say Hochul should have used the extra revenues to protect against a future downturn.
What we're seeing here could be characterized as a missed opportunity budget. With strong revenues and smart spending priorities, if we shift money from lower priority spending, we can stabilize the budget, be prepared for the feds, and support affordability programs.
Hochul's proposal is just the first step in the process. Now the Assembly and Senate will come up with their own budget plans. Assembly Speaker Carl Hastie calls the governor's budget a, quote, good opening. And Senate Majority Leader Andrea Stewart-Cousins says her conference hasn't ruled out tax increases.
You know, as we go through the process, we always have progressive taxes on the table. We always have revenue possibilities on the table. So we'll have to see what happens.
Republicans like State Senator Stephen Chan of Brooklyn criticized the spending in Hochul's plan, saying the governor should have provided more relief to taxpayers and taken steps to rein in spending.
I'm sure that the proposed $260 billion, that's going to grow, in comparison to states like Texas and Florida, we're spending much more per capita.
The budget is due by April 1st. In recent years, that deadline has passed without a budget. Hochul indicated that this year may be no different. In Albany, I'm Samuel King for the New York Public News Network.
And Governor Hochul is campaigning for a second full term. Questions are growing about how she's spending her time, though, and who she's meeting with behind closed doors. New reporting from New York Focus finds the governor's office is more than 15 months behind in releasing her official schedule.
limiting public insight into meetings with donors, lobbyists, and other powerful interests. I spoke with Chris Bragg, reporter with New York Focus, who's been digging into what the public can and can't see about the governor's calendar and campaign fundraising.
So when Governor Hochul was first taking office in 2021, she continued a practice of her predecessor, Andrew Cuomo, releasing schedules, basically kind of a bare bones version of her schedule, who she was meeting with, a list of private events that don't really have much information, but we assume are campaign fundraisers. And that stuff was being released about typically 3 months after the meetings occurred. So somewhat contemporaneous, and you had, you know, something of a current window into what the governor was doing, enough so that, you know, in the media, we could write about it and it was still relevant. Today, Hochul's office has really gotten behind. They did basically no releasing of schedules during all of 2025. And so now, as it stands, we're more than 15 months behind when the meetings were happening. So really not particularly relevant information we're getting at this point.
See, that's back to September 2024. What does that tell us about the governor's priorities and what gaps remain in understanding how she spends her time?
Yeah, I have no idea why they haven't updated it. They didn't answer questions about it. But we don't know, for instance, if somebody might have held a campaign fundraiser for her and then there was a government meeting with that same group right beforehand, something like that. Hypothetically, you could know things like that. I've done reporting in the past on Hochul misusing her, basically her state-funded aircraft. That was something that came out early in her tenure and something I picked up on from these schedules. So they can be useful for reporting stories.
There's mention of private events in her schedules, but there's a lack of detail. How does that matter for public transparency?
Yeah. Her calendar just says private event over and over again. There can be something like, you know, 40 or 50 of them in any given month. So we assume that they're mostly campaign fundraisers or meetings with campaign donors, but her office has said in the past that, you know, they can be other kinds of political meetings and things like that. So we think that they're mostly fundraisers, and obviously the governor has been a very prolific fundraiser. So she's definitely spending a lot of her time on that, but we don't know for sure in many cases. So,
you spoke to a transparency advocate, Paul Wolf, about this. What did he have to say about the refusal to release the full calendars or the lack of releasing the full information?
Well, we know that Governor Hochul said on her first day in office that she was going to bring a new air of transparency to Albany. Her predecessor, Andrew Cuomo, had been often criticized for not being transparent. And I think in many ways, Governor Hochul has not lived up to that, this being one example. So that's one thing that Paul Wolf cited. And he also noted that, other government officials have their actual Outlook calendars released. This has happened in several cases. I've seen where people, including Governor Hochul's top aide, Catherine Garcia, her actual Outlook calendar has been released in response to Freedom of Information Law requests. Hochul's office won't do that for the governor. They're just releasing this sanitized version that they clean up. So there's kind of a double standard between what they're willing to do for the governor versus every other, you know, administration official that you ask for on their calendar.
Your article mentions that some donors who paid for campaign events include lobbyists, contractors, gaming interests. Are there rules or norms about whether these donors should be meeting with the governor before or after fundraisers?
No, not really. It's pretty unregulated. In New York, corporation can donate who has business before the governor, or a person with contracts can donate. So there's really no restrictions around it that I'm aware of. Occasionally the Ethics Commission has cracked down on things like Bill de Blasio had, I think, some nonprofit fundraising for his nonprofit around the time that they had activity before de Blasio. They tried to crack down on that at one point a little bit, but nothing to really speak of that is in law, I don't think.
Hochul's office was particularly generous and forthcoming when it came to releasing the schedule and outlook calendar of Lieutenant Governor Antonio Delgado. Does that have anything to do with the fact that Lieutenant Governor is now her political opponent?
Well, we can only assume that that's the case. I found that truly incredible. I was actually, the way that came about is I was on an interview yesterday with a different radio program, the Capitol Press Room, and the host, David Lombardo, while I was on the air with him, told me about the fact that, Hochul's office, you know, he only requested 1 year of Delgado's schedule, and Hochul's office came back with three years. So they won't provide Hochul's schedule at all, but her political opponent who's running Esther for governor, they'll provide way more than you even wanted. So I find that pretty incredible.
Her schedule, Hochul's schedule, does not release as much information as we mentioned to her predecessor, Andrew Cuomo's schedules, specified when and where he was holding campaign fundraisers. Hochul's, by contrast, are you know, as you said, unspecific, quote, private events. What does she reveal, though, in her schedules? What details does she give?
There can be some useful information, like a lot of the things that are on there are meetings with, for instance, this 1 month I looked at, there was a meeting with the Canadian Prime Minister, the CEO of Disney, real estate executives, labor leaders. There's even meetings with journalists sometimes listed. You see which government staff is in those meetings, but we also don't know what's being excluded because, like I said, her Outlook calendar is not being released, so you can't see what's being blacked out. So there could be just people being left off these things that we have no idea about. So can be useful, but it's incomplete.
Meanwhile, Governor Hochul running for re-election, raising campaign funds. How's she doing when it comes to fundraising?
She's doing great. I think she raised $5.4 million the last 6 months. She has about $20 million in cash on hand. Donation limits have gone down a lot in New York. You used to be able, if you were the governor, to raise $70,000 from each individual, which was probably the highest in the country. It's down to $18,000 now because of a law that was passed a few years ago. The twist is that donations that are smaller are now matched with public dollars. So that could give her opponents some parity. She's running against, as mentioned, Delgado in the Democratic primary and then Bruce Blakeman in the general election, presumably. So that new system could give them a little more of a leg up than you traditionally would have, but she's still got a big lead. So,
has the campaign disclosed any information about who's actually thrown campaign fundraisers for Governor Hochul?
Yeah, because they have to. Basically, if somebody pays for part of the expense of a campaign fundraiser, like pays for the room or pays for food or whatever, then that has to be disclosed as a what's called an in-kind contribution. So you see some activity on her campaign finance report of who has been throwing the fundraisers. So there were maybe 10 listed in her most recent one, or like a lobbyist from Greenberg Traurig is maybe the one that stood out the most to me. But you see a little bit of that, but if you don't have these people paying for part of the fundraiser, then you have no idea who's throwing it.
And we don't know when these meetings took place in advance of fundraisers or after. For folks trying to follow this and understand, what would a fully transparent calendar look like? Is it realistic to expect this from Governor Hochul at this point?
Well, in 2014, Politico New York did an open records request for Governor Cuomo's calendar, specifically related to finding out details of some campaign fundraisers that Cuomo had. And the Committee on Open Government, which is a state agency that issues opinions about the FOIA law, came back with an opinion saying, yes, Cuomo should release the information about these fundraisers because they're tied basically to his official government duties. So if that were actually followed, if the state government followed its own agency's recommendations, then you would have full information about who was throwing campaign fundraisers, everybody that the governor was meeting with, et cetera. And you could really actually know what was going on behind the scenes. But doesn't seem like you know, without some litigation by someone, maybe it'll be New York Focus even, we will be getting that answer. So
that's Chris Bragg. He is the Albany Bureau Chief at New York Focus. You can read his reporting at nysfocus.com. Chris, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Up next, blood supplies in parts of New York are running dangerously low. Coming up, what you need to know about donating and what's most needed and where you can make a difference close to home. This is Radio Chatskill.
Support comes from Garnet Health Medical Center, Catskills. From inpatient and outpatient care to primary, urgent, and specialty care with Garnet Health doctors in Sullivan County. Exceptional lives here. Learn more at garnethealth.org.
So here's the deal. Public radio is now operating without federal funding, and your support matters more than ever. One way to help is to donate that car, truck, or old motorcycle in your driveway. You clear out some space and help keep trusted news coverage alive in your community. The process? Simple, free, even tax deductible. Just head to this station's website and help us keep this work going together.
Donate your car, boat, or motorcycle at wjffradio.org.
On This Old House Radio Hour, the fastest, most affordable ways to refresh your space. Upgrades you can do in a weekend, sometimes in an hour.
A little light behind the TV changes the glow in the room. Table lamp will add a certain shade. These are ways that you can layer light.
Plus, author John Grisham on why some houses become impossible to leave. That's this week on This Old House Radio Hour. Sunday morning at 7 on Radio Catskill.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. New York is facing a blood supply shortage, and health officials say the situation is becoming critical. The American Red Cross and regional partners, including the New York Blood Center, report that in parts of the state, donations are running nearly 40% below hospital demand. O-type blood, along with A-negative and B-negative, is especially needed. Of course, blood is essential for everyday hospital care, from emergency trauma response and childbirth to cancer treatment and chronic conditions like sickle cell disease. Nationwide, someone in the U.S. needs blood every 2 seconds, and when supplies run low, hospitals may be forced to delay or limit care. Joining us now, Jennifer Malinchak, a registered nurse and manager of occupational health and wellness at Garnet Health, which is partnering with the New York Blood Center to host a community blood drive. It's January is National Blood Donor Month. We should also note, as you heard earlier, Garnet Health is a financial supporter of Radio Catskill. Jennifer, thanks for being here.
Tim, good morning. Thank you so much for having me join you this morning and providing this opportunity to share information about our blood drive.
Yeah.
And that's happening on Wednesday.
Yeah. And at a critical time, as I said, there's that blood shortage, critical shortage of the state. January, National Absolutely. Blood Donor Month, of course, that time set aside to highlight this ongoing need for blood donations, and especially critical now, especially in the winter. For listeners who may not be familiar, why does this month exist in the first place?
So this month exists because donations during January are so low. In 1969, actually, President Nixon declared January to be National Blood Donation Month. So that started in 1970, so it has a long history. Of course, supply is down in January for various reasons. As you can imagine, the weather, right? We have an impending storm coming this weekend, wintertime illnesses, the holidays. People are planning holiday events and also travel. So blood donation may not be at the forefront of people's minds.
You're on the front lines there at Garnet Health, registered nurse, manager of occupational health and wellness. How does the winter season affect the blood supply compared to other times of the year? And what are you seeing right now, especially in light of the statewide blood shortage?
Yeah, so there's a critical shortage right now, so that impacts the ability that we have to provide blood products to our patients, right? There may be a delay in discharges, delays on infusions. People may need to stay in the hospital longer or reschedule infusions or surgeries. So we do see it here on the front lines, blood donation in blood transfusions are an integral part of what we do here to service the community. So we're impacted greatly when there is a shortage.
You know, when people hear blood donation, they often think of emergencies or trauma care. And I tried to outline in the introduction there that there are more things going on. Can you just explain a little bit more on a day-to-day basis? Who's actually relying on donated blood in our local hospitals?
So absolutely, Tim. So actually, more than 25% of the blood supply goes to treat cancer patients.
Wow.
So that's a huge number. In addition to cancer patients, we have patients that have chronic illness that require transfusions of blood products. So it really impacts not only, you know, during times of trauma, catastrophic events, it's also day-to-day treatment of patients, improving their quality of life and saving lives.
Let's talk about you know, why it matters and maybe some listener concerns. Some people want to help, but maybe they feel hesitant. Maybe they're a little squeamish. Mm-hmm. Maybe they're worried about pain or time or even eligibility. What do you tell somebody who's on the fence about donating, especially right now?
Right. It's quite understandable. The New York Blood Center has been doing this for well over 60 years. The professionals, they make the process as easy and seamless as possible. Usually takes about an hour of your time. Come in, there's a screening process, and the actual donation time is about 15 minutes. Mm-hmm. So it's a relatively short period of time where you can make a huge impact on the well-being of the community. So despite the small amount of discomfort you may experience, the rewards are great, and there's always the juice and cookies at the end.
I was going to ask, do I still get a cracker and cookies or juice? Yes. Okay, good.
Yes.
So generally speaking, who can donate blood? Are there certain guidelines or restrictions we should remind folks about?
Yeah, so that's a great question. Basically, you need to be feeling well and in good health. You need to weigh at least 110 pounds. Folks between the ages of 16 and 75 can donate. 16-year-olds need parental permission, and those 76 and older would need a doctor's note. But basically, most people, if you feel well, you're healthy, you're not currently sick, you're able to donate.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Jennifer Malinchak, a registered nurse and manager of occupational health and wellness at Garnet Health. There is an upcoming blood drive. We'll get the details in a little bit. Because there's a shortage, an emergency, a critical shortage in New York at this time of year. But before we get into details of that blood drive, Jennifer, I just want to ask you a little bit more about your work in occupational health and wellness, which focuses on prevention and community well-being. And talk about how donating blood fits into that bigger picture of public health.
Yeah. So donating blood is a relatively easy contribution that people can make to improving the well-being and the health of our communities. Every 2 seconds, someone needs blood. So there's a huge demand. And at least 62% of the U.S. population is eligible to donate, but only 3% do, right? So there's a huge opportunity for education and sharing the importance of blood donation and how it saves lives. So there's many, many ways that blood products are used. So it's not only cancer patients, it could be burn victims, people undergoing transplants, people that may have blood disorders, bleeding disorders, newborns. Sometimes during childbirth, there's a need for blood. So really, it impacts everybody in the community and improves their well-being and their health.
Have you seen firsthand how a strong local donor base makes a difference for patients in the region?
Absolutely. You know, we have patients, not only like surgical patients, traumas, every day, all throughout the hospital, and even in our outpatient facilities, people are receiving blood and blood products. So it really improves people's lives, not only and saves lives.
And we talked about people who may be on the fence about donating, but what about people who have donated in the past? Why is it important to keep coming back, especially now?
Yeah, so the need is so great right now, and you're able to donate approximately every 2 months, like 56 days. So if you have already donated, you understand the process, the rewards of donation are so great. I encourage you to return as a donor, continue to contribute to the well-being of our community, those in need. As I said, 1 hour of your time, it makes a huge difference in someone's life, their quality of life.
Let's give folks information and all the details about the upcoming blood drive. You're partnering sure. with the New York Blood Center for that community blood drive. Let's get the details.
So the blood drive is going to be Wednesday, January 28th. It's from 10 a.m. until 6 p.m. It's being held at our Middletown location, so Garner Health Medical Center. It's 707 East Main Street in Middletown, New York. It's right off of Route 17. For those that may not know where we're located, easy access. You can come in the main entrance. Also, the side entrance by the conference center will be open. You can come directly in there. You can pre-register if you go to our website, garnethealth.org, the events page. You can easily schedule an appointment. There are appointments available. So you can pre-register for a time that's convenient for you. Come at your assigned time, and basically it's the screening process, the donation, and then a little juice and cookies at the end. And with the impending snowstorm, this gives you the perfect opportunity to get out of the house, do a little socialization, have some snacks, and feel good about contributing to the well-being and wellness of our community.
Absolutely. This will be Wednesday after the snow is expected to come on Monday. So hopefully, you know, things will be cleared. And as you said, good to get out of the house there. And are you recommending or requiring appointments or pre-registration, just to be clear?
Well, it's not required. Okay. Absolutely. We accept walk-ins. But for folks constraint, would like to plan ahead, you're more than welcome to go to the website or also walk-ins.
Okay.
Are more than welcome.
That's Jennifer Malinchak, Manager of Occupational Health and Wellness at Garnet Health. There is the Garnet Health Medical Center's Occupational Health and Wellness Department partnering with the New York Blood Center to host that community blood drive on Wednesday, January 28th from 10 to 6 at Garnet Health Medical Center in Middletown. More information at garnethealth.org. Jennifer, thank you so much. And I want to just say, prior to coming on air, you said you were a little nervous, but guess what? You did great. Thank you.
Thank you, Tim. This has been wonderful. Thank you so much for the opportunity. It's been a pleasure.
Well, thanks for all you're doing there, too, as one of our strong nurses there on the front line. Thank you.
My pleasure. All right. You're most welcome.
We'll take a break. And when we come back at Fair Hill Therapeutic Riding Center, horses are helping people learn, heal, and connect, often without saying a word. Coming up next, equine-assisted learning and the growing role of therapeutic riding. This is Radio Chatskill.
Hey, it's Francis Lam, host of The Splendid Table. This week, it's a live event on the incredible food culture of Hawaii. We talk with Top Chef star Sheldon Simeon, James Beard Award-winning chef Robin Mai, and many more guests, trying to find out why Hawaii is maybe the best place on earth to eat. It's coming up on The Splendid Table.
The Splendid Table, Sunday morning at 11 on Radio Catskill.
It's award season, so next time on the Buckaroo Monkeys with me, Graham Rice, here on Radio Catskill, we'll hear tracks from all the contenders for the 2025 Folk Music Awards. So join me, please, for the shortlisted albums in the latest British and Irish Folk Music Awards on Sunday afternoon at 3.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Tavern on Main, where modern American cuisine meets classic favorites. Dinner, weekend brunch, craft cocktails, and warm hospitality on Main Street in Jeffersonville. More at TavernOnMainNY.com.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Horses have long been known for their strength and grace, but for many people, they're also powerful teachers. At Fair Hill Therapeutic Riding Center in Waymart, Pennsylvania, horses are helping individuals build confidence, communication skills, and emotional connection in ways that traditional classrooms or therapy rooms often cannot. Joining us today is Vera Reams, a PATH International Certified Therapeutic Riding Instructor, to tell us more about the work they do at Fair Hill. Vera, thanks for joining us.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm doing pretty well. And tell us a little bit more about Fair Hill Therapeutic Riding Center and what you guys do there.
Well, I love that Sally, our executive director, has structured her lessons there as 1 hour lessons or sessions where she teaches not only riding skills, and then with therapeutic riding, uses the movement and presence of the horse to support physical and emotional and cognitive skills. But she also is really concerned with having our students, our participants, develop connection with our equines, because they could do stuff we really can't do with words. We're very we're centered around horsemanship education, but the therapeutic environment centers around the horse. We have that 1 hour lesson, which I have never seen at other centers. And she's pretty adamant about keeping that and having the rider really connect with the horse before we even try to teach a skill. So there are skills and then there's connection for our riders.
You talk about connection before directions. What does that
right.
mean? What's that mean in practice? And why is that so important when working with both horses and people?
Well, you know, I once tried to explain it, and I took one of those skitch-wow things, and I had, like, the horse with little arrows to all the people, and then I had the client with all the little arrows, and when I got done, it looked like cats in a cradle or something, but that's really what it is. When you get a horse involved, when you get an equine involved, they affect everyone in the air. In fact, there's even research that says that within 40 to, I think, 60 feet, their heartbeat will lower the heartbeat of all the people in the lesson. So it's called heart rate variability. I could go on about that. But what it really is telling you that during a lesson, the most important component is the horse, and that your ability to connect with the horse for the rider affects them deeply in areas we can't even measure. You know, we can measure riding skills, but for the other things, we have to see how they, improve all the things, like instead of their emotional behavior, they're dealing with anxiety or trauma or life transitions. And our parents report to us that there is big improvements. And just one little tiny vignette, you know, when you see a kid who's never, or hear a kid who's never said a word tell their horse to walk on, you know, your heart just swells. It's incredible. Yeah.
You know, for folks who may not know what the details of equine-assisted learning and therapeutic riding and what makes it different from traditional riding or therapy, can you talk a little bit about what a session is like, what actually happens during a typical visit at the program?
Sure. When they come, it starts long before they ever get on a horse, because we meet them on the ground and we practice breathing exercises, and what that does is it slows their breathing. And when you do that, you know, it slows everything down. And we try to encourage our participants to notice their own body language and how it affects the equines. And, you know, if you want to be part of their of the equine circle of friends, you can't be, they can see the effect of jumping up and down as opposed to being calm and gentle with the horse. So that helps them in life, that the behaviors that they might need to get along in life. So that's the first half of the lesson, is all about that, and it's grooming or whatever whatever that particular participant may need at that particular time. And we're in contact with the parents all the time. So, you know, if a kid had a bad day, we're going to know it not only from the kid, but from the parents, and we'll adjust. So one session, even with the same participant, doesn't look like the next session. Then also we start with the riding process, and we can track riding and what makes therapeutic riding different from regular riding instruction is that the movement of the horse, because if someone's on a horse and they're moving, it approximates the movement of the human body and walking. So you'll often see an improvement in gait and balance and coordination. And what I always, when I mentor my instructors, I always say, never stop the horses. Keep them going. No matter what you're doing with one, you want everybody to walk, because when they're walking, you're helping them with their balance and their coordination and all the things that are kind of indefinable and you can't really teach. Mm-hmm. It's the horses doing that, you know. So it's quite a pairing of skill. At least with PATH, we have to have a riding skill like turning or stopping or going. But there's always that other indefinable part of the balance and the coordination, and maybe even how they get along with people and how what they do affects the horse in terms of their actions, like if they're moving too much. But that maybe they should still themselves, and we'll do breathing exercises when they're on the horse as well if we see that there's a problem. So instruction for the volunteers and instructors and even the parents get in on it, because I'll give them and my things to work on at home, you know, exercises and stuff. So,
You mentioned some of the changes you've seen in some of the folks who participate in these sessions over time.
Yeah.
Who are the people you most often serve, and what are some of the other changes you do see?
Well, we serve children with developmental and intellectual disabilities and some behavioral disabilities also. But we have adults, and they're the ones that we have one woman who has a very bad back. So the movement of the horse helps her because she really can't walk that well. Mm. But it's approximating the movement of the horse. So when she gets off the horse, she feels better. So there's people doing it strictly for that, but also for having an emotion built up with the horse, some sort of relationship. And we do have stable moments, which I don't know if you know what that is. That's where we have a program for foster children. And they need mentors very badly, and you don't have to have any experience. You get an online course that teaches you what to do. You have an hour with the foster child. And I just took the course because I feel like a shark. If I don't keep moving forward, I can't, you know, I'm going to not, something will happen bad. So, I took the mentor course, and I'd like to start it myself with a foster child. So that's something we want to get up and running. So besides stable moments and the other people that we'll serve as veterans. One of my people that I serve on the board with has is getting a doctorate in military families. So we're hoping at some point in the future to serve as veterans, and senior citizens are always welcome. community people, but also people from the school systems that might be in classes where they need extra help. Because when you change a person's attitude, other things come along with it. And a lot of this changes attitude. It changes how people think of themselves and how they think of all the people around them and how they're able to change. Because that's what the horse does for you. That's what these ones do. I wish I could show everybody.
Well, you can. I was just going to say, you're very involved in training instructors and volunteers, and you're looking for volunteers. You, along with Nancy Van Wyck, are facilitating that volunteer training coming up Saturday, January 31st. Tell folks about what they can expect if they're new or returning volunteers.
Well, PATH, who is our parent organization, PATH International, they require one volunteer training a year. We'll offer it as one big four-hour, training. But even if you want to do it, if you're not able to make that, we'll do a onboarding activity at another time where we've adjusted our class to do that. But what Nancy and I will do is basically a PowerPoint that will refer to Sally has done this fantastic job of putting together a volunteer manual that has, I've never seen anything so complete. It looks like the Bible of volunteer training. It's got everything in it with pictures. And I mean, it's a great thing for a volunteer to have, because they could always, if they have a problem, look at it. And what I've been trying to do is make it into little cards that maybe a volunteer could have. So we're interested in getting people that could volunteer even if they have no training at all, and making them into really good trainers, volunteers that can interact with the professionals as well as the participants and the family. I would say if anybody's listening and they're curious, that they Facebook has some ads on it from our Facebook page for Fair Hill, but also, that it's going to be in Waymart at Maplewood Farms that day, and it's only 4 hours. And when you're done, you can volunteer, and then we'll take you under our wing and keep you going.
Yeah.
You'll never feel stranded, because we love our volunteers, and they're the best. Like senior citizens sometimes volunteer because it's walking next to a horse, so they get the interaction with the horse, but now they're walking. They get the steps in, they do all the stuff that keeps them young. Yeah. And so it's really, it's a great community. I'm at Fair Hill, that's over at Winsome. I don't go to Maplewood that much, but I do know when I walk into the barn at Winsome, I feel that warm and fuzzy feeling that you get when you're in a place where people are just so accepting of whatever disability you might have or whatever ability. I don't call it disabilities anymore. I call it differing abilities. it's a very accepting place.
Oh, yeah.
I haven't been at Maplewood that much, but I sense the same kind of thing. So,
let me remind folks.
Writing is great.
Yeah, and I'm sorry to interrupt, but we're running out of time.
Okay.
I want to make sure I get the details folks. That volunteer training at Fair Hill Therapeutic Writing Center in Waymart is Saturday, January 31st from 11 to 3 at Maplewood Farms. It's for returning volunteers who want to get their yearly training and updated paperwork done. And for new volunteers, there's more information at fairhill.farm. And we've been speaking to Vera Reams, a PATH International Certified Therapeutic Writing Instructor and Equine Assisted Learning Specialist at Fair Hill Therapeutic Writing Center. Vera, thank you so much. Thanks for sharing your warm and fuzzy feelings with us today. It was a delight talking to you.
And one thing, volunteer training will not be dry and academic. Nancy and I are like comedians.
I have no doubt.
On the road when we do this. So just so you know, it'll be entertaining as well. Anyway.
The comedy stylings of Vera Rames. Thank you so much.
And Nancy.
We appreciate it. Thank you. Yeah.
All right. Thank you so much, Tim, for giving me this opportunity.
Of course. Thanks so much. We'll take a break. And when we come back, Headwater Arts Center inviting the community to escape the winter cold with the Wintertide film series. This is Radio Chatskill.
This week on Cat's Cast, a special conversation with a giant in the world of fishing, books, and books about fishing, the Catskill's own Nick Lyons.
Here you get to know the water. The Beaver Kill is just filled with memory. It's filled with history. And I think the fishing was of a different sort.
Saturday at 11 a.m. right here on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. The Wintertide film series kicks off tomorrow at Headwaters Arts Center in Stamford, running through April. Culture reporter Valerie Manzi talked with organizer Rachel Condrey about the films and the vision behind this series.
Another cold winter's day here in the Catskills, but that doesn't stop Headwaters Arts Center from creating a Wintertide film series. And today, Rachel Condrey is here to talk to us about it. When does your film series begin?
It starts this Friday, January 23rd at 6 o'clock. We'll be showing a really fantastic film called Samsara. Without any words, it's just images and music, and sort of gives us a real zoomed out perspective of our planet and ourselves.
And how do folks find out more about the series? What's the website?
Our website is roxburyartsgroup.org, and search for events, and all of our films that we're showing are listed there at this time.
And this first film just sounds very intriguing because it's a visual meditation, so to speak.
Correct.
A wordless exploration of in 25 different countries.
Correct. It was filmed over 5 years in 25 different countries. And it's sort of in line with classic films like Kwanaskatsi or Baraka. Actually, this filmmaker is the same who did the film Baraka. And they're a particular genre of film that has no words and just images to tell profound stories and give us some new views on ourselves.
I saw, how do we say it, Kanawaska?
Oh, Kwanaskatsi, yeah.
Yeah, okay. I saw that years ago, and it was impressive.
Indeed, yeah. I'm a fan of this style of movie. In fact, this was my personal promotion. I wanted to see this film, and I have not seen it yet, and it'll be exciting to share it with folks at Headwaters on Friday.
It will be because, you know, the winter is a time of solitude in some respects and quiet, and this engages that in a very positive way.
I think so too. And you know, the whole idea behind the film series for us and other programs we're doing this year, like our Art for Wellness program on Wednesday evenings, is just kind of about creating connection. But I think also it's a natural time of year for reflection and maybe new perspective, which is why we're starting the series with Samsara.
Well, you're always up to something there at Headwaters. I see here that your Valentine's Day film will be The Princess Bride by Rob Reiner, who we recently lost.
Correct. We had already selected that film as our Valentine's Day, and then unfortunately we lost Rob after that. But it seems like maybe a happy coincidence to revisit one of his most popular films and personally one of my personal favorites.
And following that on the 27th, I see here you have Charade.
That's correct.
And yes, who is
with
that?
Audrey Hepburn.
Right. Audrey Hepburn and Cary Grant.
Correct. Yeah. So it's a high intrigue and also I think a lot of it has some comedy elements. And we wanted to do some films in the public domain and opted to choose one that was in color and that just became available in the public domain this year.
Oh, wonderful.
And that would be Charade. Mm-hmm.
And then we get to March, where you'll have two other films. One is Flow, and then Fritz Lang's Metropolis. Wow.
Yeah, so we have another wordless film in the form of mm-hmm. Flow, which won an Oscar last year, and it's just a phenomenal piece and a really like innovative use of animation as well as storytelling through basically animals surviving after a flood and helping one another out in a kind of post-apocalyptic Earth-like setting. And by Fritz Lang is a classic early film, huge production. It is a black and white film. It depicts the year 2026, which we thought was notable, and what was imagined to be a year 2026 where there is society is divided between a wealthy class and then the workers. It's quite inventive and Art Deco style.
Oh yeah,
we thought it was appropriate also because of the happenstance that's set in this year. So it's an interesting to look back and see what in the 1920s what people were looking ahead and thinking of our time period to be.
And then in April, this is very special. You have Local Lens Showcase, which of course at that time. We'll interview the filmmakers. Tell us a little bit about that.
Right. Well, so right now we have an open call available. Uh-huh. It's open until March 7th. We have had a couple submissions so far, so we're excited. If you're a filmmaker or you work in film, this is a great opportunity to show your work locally and have a chance for a Q&A session. So we have two, one for short films under 30 minutes and another one for more full-length films in April. And you're invited, anyone is invited who has, a film they would like to submit. And the process is quite simple. It's all online on our website again, under open calls. There's a form you can fill out. And yeah, we're looking forward to it. We know that there's quite a lot of film makers and other talented folks who work in the film industry in our area. And so we really wanted to highlight them, give them a chance to connect with our local audiences and for people to realize what is around us in terms of talents.
Well, this has been a wonderful conversation with you, and it makes the winter seem quite a bit more bearable.
We hope so. That's what we're going for.
Okay. So can you give us the website again for folks to find out more about the films that will begin this Friday, the 23rd, and also about submitting their own films for the future?
So I want to say that all of the film screenings are free to attend, but we will be selling some concessions, hot chocolate, popcorn, that sort of thing, sodas and candies, as one often gets at the film, at movies. So you can bring your own seating if you want to bring blankets for the floor or bring your own chairs. We will have chairs there, but we want it to be cozy and kind of like a community living room setting. And you can find more about the schedule and information about the films on our website, which is roxburyartsgroup.org. And under our performances and events tab. And if you're interested in submitting to our open call for the film, Local Lens film series that we're doing in April, that is also on our website, roxburyartsgroup.org, under open calls.
Well, thank you so much, Rachel, for taking the time to share this with us all here in the Catskills.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
You are welcome.
Thanks to culture reporter Valerie Manzi. That'll do it for this edition of Radio Chatskill. A reminder to sign up for our free weekly newsletter. It goes to your inbox every Friday. If you sign up today, you'll get it tomorrow. It's at wjffradio.org. Stay connected and informed about what's going on in local news and culture with our free weekly newsletter. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
Support comes from Sullivan Allies Leading Together. Committed to ensuring the safety of our community. Protect those most important by keeping medications in a secure space. Be a part of the solution. More at saltcares.com.
I'm Kimberly Izar, host of Farming Country. This week, John Van Etten of the Sullivan County Conservation Club shares ice fishing safety tips and his favorite stories on the ice.
My personal best ever fishing through the ice, I caught 77 fish in 1 hour.
Plus, join Ronald Kelson as he hits the slopes at Holiday Mountain in Bridgeville. That's this week on Farming Country, Saturday morning at 10 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR. Today's weather, breezy, not as cold, maybe a couple of snow showers this afternoon, high 36. Tonight, cloudy and a low of 12. Of course, everyone's got eyes on that major winter storm impacting the area Sunday. First cold coming in, snow showers, breezy, colder tomorrow, 22 for a high, minus 5 for a low tomorrow night. Saturday's high, only 8. And then Sunday, frigid. It looks like we're currently seeing 3 to 6 inches of snow, but the National Weather Service is still keeping an eye on it. Snowfall could be very heavy at times Sunday through Sunday night, with hourly rates exceeding 1 inch per hour. A winter storm watch is in effect from late Saturday night through Monday evening.